was looking at the Facebook page promoting this event, and I realized I'm supposed to explain God, suffering, evil, sin, and creation in 45 minutes. That's not going to happen. That's way too much, but I'm happy to answer questions about any of those in the Q&A. I'm not going to say anything about creation in this talk. I'll say a little bit about suffering, but maybe less than you'd hope. I'm going to say quite a bit about sin in order to set up what I think is its central and enduring mystery. And maybe we can say a little bit about how to navigate that mystery in your life, given that you'll basically have to. I should also admit outright that I am not going to solve the so-called problem of evil tonight. You're not going to leave thinking everything is completely solved and that Aquinas or I had it all figured out. I think there's a kind of deep existential problem of evil that remains for us as human beings. And the best that I can do as a philosopher is help you to think about that, because I think that your perspective on evil is probably the most important tool that you have for dealing with it in a practical way in your life. And that includes the evil that's in your heart, because there's some of that there too, which is another mystery that, we will definitely talk about in this talk. So I want to talk about how to think about evil conceptually, how I think about evil. And I want to highlight some of the philosophical problems and puzzles that evil presents. I think there are philosophical resources for sorting out how to think about evil from a philosophical perspective. So we'll try to do that. If you look at your handout, I have some of the classic philosophical formulations of the problem of evil that you would be very likely to encounter in a philosophy class. So there is what's called the logical problem of evil. This is the standard way to set up the problem, and it comes from David Hume. David Hume was a Scottish Enlightenment philosopher, and he wrote a very famous, very influential work called The Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. And there, Hume tried to argue that belief in God is logically inconsistent. So if you look at these four propositions on your handout, right? Proposition one, God exists and he's omnipotent. So he's all powerful. Two, God exists and he's omniscient. So he knows everything. Three, God exists and he's omnibenevolent. He's perfectly good. He's perfectly goodwill. Four, evil exists. So Hume presents these propositions as an inconsistent set. And he says, look, at least one of these has to go. And it's not going to be four, right? Because evil exists. That's a reality. We can't deny that. So that means that either God isn't omnipotent, or he's not omniscient, or he's not omnibenevolent. But if God isn't any one of those things, then the God of classical theism doesn't exist. So we either have to change our concept of God, we have to revise it somehow to make it possible that we can reconcile God with the existence of evil, or, and I think this is clearly what Hume wants, you should just stop believing in God. Now, I don't have much to say about this problem, except to note that it's not a logical problem at all. So the problem of evil in this form, I think, can be pretty easily dismissed because there isn't, strictly speaking, anything logically contradictory going on here. So it's both logically and metaphysically possible that God is not the cause of evil and in his infinite wisdom has reasons to permit evil to happen. Reasons that we, because we have a very finite and limited perspective, can't discern. So given that those are real possibilities, there's no logical contradiction. So the logical problem of evil doesn't turn out to be a real problem. But that doesn't mean that there's not a problem of evil, because there are other ways to formulate the problem. One of them is the evidentiary problem of evils. That would be the second formulation on the handout. We might conclude, given the amount and the kinds of evil and suffering in the world, especially the kind of artfully cruel and tremendously horrible kind, we might conclude that we don't have very good evidence that the God of classical theism exists, right? So we can admit that, sure, it's possible, it's logically, it's metaphysically possible that he exists, but there's really just not very good evidence that he exists, given the amount of evil in the world. Now, this version of the problem of evil is the stuff of a lot of contemporary analytic philosophy of religion, which tends to treat this as an issue of formal epistemology. So they'll try to calculate and weight credences, and they will hope that the equations come out in favor of believing a God at the end of the day. So there's a lot of literature on that. I am not impressed with the evidentiary problem of evil, and I don't think you should be especially impressed by it either. But for now, I'm just going to kind of table it and turn to what on the handout is called the moral problem of evil. So there's a question that remains about the moral problem of evil. So there's the logical problem, there's the evidentiary problem, and there's the moral problem of evil. So the moral problem of evil takes a slightly different tack. It says, look, it's immoral to worship a God who permits the gratuitous suffering of innocence, right? So this version of the argument, I think its most famous instantiation is in Dostoevsky's very famous, very long novel, The Brothers Karamazov. So in a chapter called Rebellion, you have the Brothers Karamazov is a novel about three brothers. One of them, Ivan, is kind of a young 19th century intellectual, and like most 19th century intellectuals of his class status, he's an atheist and something of a socialist. And his younger brother, Alyosha, is training to be a monk. So obviously the brothers have very different perspectives on life. And Ivan is confronting Alyosha, and he's saying, look, you know, think about all of the gratuitous suffering in the world, but especially, he's especially struck by the suffering of young children. And Dostoevsky goes through all of these real-world examples. So Dostoevsky used to take all of these clippings from the newspapers. And so he's giving Alyosha all of these real examples of really disgusting forms of torture and suffering and death that pertain to young children. And he puts it to Alyosha this way. He says, look, if a beautiful world and all of creation depends on the suffering of one innocent child, would you be the architect of such a world? So just imagine that everything's going to be great, except one child is going to have to suffer gratuitously. Would you be the architect of such a world? And Alyosha says, no, he would not. And Ivan says to him, well, look, you know, you tell me to embrace the world, to love the world, it's God's creation. But he says, I return my ticket. Like, I don't want to embrace this world. And it's very clear that it's not just the case that it's hard to embrace the world. I mean, it is kind of hard to embrace suffering and turn it into a positive thing. But it's very clear that Ivan thinks it's immoral. It's completely immoral and wrong to embrace a world in which children gratuitously suffer, and the Christian ideal that we should love the world and see God's hand in it is deeply problematic, and that we shouldn't do that. So that's one way of thinking about the problem of evil that I think is the most difficult. Now, Dostoevsky thinks, and I agree with him about this, that there's no easy, neat, tidy argument that's going to tackle the moral problem of evil. The best you could probably do is try to show that it rests on some kind of mistake. Like maybe there's a hidden premise that doesn't make sense, and so the problem itself kind of dissolves rather than accepting the problem and trying to find a solution to it. But I'm not going to go that route, although I have sympathies with that route. For now, I just want to say something about how we should think about evil so that our minds have a grip about what we're thinking about in general. And in particular, I want to think about a specific kind of evil, and that is the evil of sin. And the perspective that I'm going to take, not surprisingly, since it's a Thomistic Institute talk, is the perspective of Thomas Aquinas. It's also a perspective that I find very helpful and pretty much true. So, evil. Aquinas has, to modern ears, a strangely capacious notion of evil. So the Latin word for evil is just malum. When we hear someone talk about evil, we tend to think of, like, really bad things, right? Plagues, genocides, torture, something really awful. But Aquinas is, like, way more relaxed about what counts as evil. So evil is just any privation or lack of a good that is appropriate to some being. So evil can be pretty minor. If a bad oyster causes a retired Nazi hiding out in Argentina to have a stomach ache, that counts as an evil for Aquinas. It's a stomach ache. That's like an evil. If a magnolia flower on my tree in the front yard fails to bloom, that's an evil. So it's a very general sense of just a lack of a good that's appropriate to some being, right? My flower should bloom. The Nazi hiding out in Argentina shouldn't have a stomach ache. The second thing to say about evil is that it's derivative. It's derivative conceptually, and it's derivative ontologically. That is to say that evil is a lack. It's an absence. An absence of what? An absence of some form or due order or measure in something, in some reality. So to be something is to have being. So I want to say a little something about what Aquinas thinks about being. And I'm going to be pretty breezy about this metaphysics because I don't want to get too much into the weeds about it. We can talk about it in the Q&A if you want. But one thing to say about how Aquinas thinks about being or reality is that there's no single account or definition of being. So for Aquinas, it doesn't make sense to talk about just being as such. The primary sense of being for Aquinas is substances. So I'm a substance, you're a substance, a dog is a substance, a houseplant is a substance. What makes substances unique is that they exist through themselves, whereas other modes of being only exist in substances. So to talk about modes of being is to talk about something like place, quality, quantity, relation, things like this. Those would all be things that pertain to a substance. Now, the primary sense of being, which is substance, reveals what Aquinas calls a thing's nature. So if you imagine, like, an alien comes down to Earth and he encounters LeBron James, and he asks, in whatever language this alien has, like, what is this? What is it? And somebody says, oh, it's an American. Well, yeah, the alien would learn something true about LeBron. LeBron is an American, but he wouldn't really know what LeBron is in the fundamental sense, in the sense that reveals his nature. Because, of course, LeBron tomorrow could renounce his American citizenship. He would not stop being what he is. Because what LeBron is the same thing as what you and I are. He's a human being. All of us in this room, according to Aquinas' metaphysics, we have a common nature. We're all human beings. Aquinas thinks that we're individuated by our matter. That's another talk. But we all fundamentally have the same nature, so the same capacities, and we sort of seek the same goods, even though we're all individual, unique substances. Now, since we're substances, we're agents. That means that we act, but we act according to what Aquinas calls, and here he's following Aristotle, an internal principle of activity, movement, or rest that persists over time and through its own acts. So that basically just means that the explanation of what we do makes some kind of necessary appeal to the thing that we are. So if you want to know what I'm up to, you have to know that I'm a human being. Otherwise, you can't make sense of what's going on with me. And in this sense, I'm like any other living thing, and so are you. The explanation of what I'm doing, my movements, it depends on form. Now, Aquinas also thinks that all living things, all substances, have a natural good. A natural good is kind of a perfected condition that is the full realization of its potentiality. So we all have capacities. I have a capacity for sight. I have a capacity for locomotion. I'm exercising both of these capacities right now. I have a capacity for speech. So when I exercise these capacities, right, I am realizing some potential that pertains to my being. So basically, my perfected condition, which is what Aquinas calls happiness, it's going to be the full realization of my human capacities towards the highest end that they could realize. So just for now, call whatever that is happiness, and that's my natural good and your natural good as a human being. Now Aquinas thinks that all substances have such a natural good, and that the perfection of a living thing just is its complete actualization of these capacities. Now, if you have that view of a thing's good, and you think that evil is a lack of something that pertains to the form of a thing, then you get a picture of a kind of natural evil or a natural lack. So every instance of evil is going to fit this general metaphysical schema. It's going to be the failure of a substance to realize its full potentiality. So an oak tree might fail to develop strong roots, and it might do this for any number of reasons: lack of rain, exposure to a virus, got a genetic defect. Now, this kind of oak, the one that doesn't grow the strong roots, one could say truly that its condition is bad, it's evil. And it's evil because it's lacking something that's due to it, given the kind of thing that it is. And furthermore, you can say that it's desirable for an oak tree to attain its perfected state of existence. Because anything short of this is going to be imperfect or incomplete for it. So perfection is just, and this is on your handout, it's just the ontological condition that lacks nothing that ought to pertain to a thing given the kind of substance that it is. So its capacities are in full actuality, and it's achieved its characteristic natural good. Okay, and evil is just the opposite of that. It's lacking in that in some respect. It might just be a little bit. It might be a lot. It might be death, which would be sort of total privation. The thing that's really important about this picture, and that I think is true, is that evil is not an independent ontological reality. So it's not like an independent thing that can be described. It's parasitic. Right, so it's ontologically and conceptually parasitic. And that's why Aquinas says evil can only be in good. So you can't know what an evil is unless you know the good that pertains to the substance in question, right? So I can't know that it's bad for the oak to have a weak root system unless I know what a flourishing condition is for an oak tree. And moreover, unless I know that a strong root system is necessary to create and sustain that perfected condition. So that's just evil on the whole. Now, sin, when the Latin word here is peccatum, is a very special sort of evil. And it's the one that I mostly want to focus on. But it's gonna fit that general schema of evil as being a defect or lack and something that's due to a thing given its being. But whereas malum generally refers to any privation of being, Sin more specifically refers to defective acts. And these would be acts that lack due measure or order that belong to a thing by its nature. This Latin word, peccatum, it comes from the Greek word hamartia, which literally means to miss the mark. So in Greek literature, especially Greek tragedy, this word, which we would translate as sin, really just means not hitting the mark or the target. And that's basically Aquinas' account of sin. It's not hitting the mark. So there's a little definition of sin that he gives in the Summa Theologiae. Sin properly consists in an action done for a certain end and lacking due order to that end. So the end would be the target, right, that you're meant to hit. So your action is successful if you hit the target. So suppose your action is playing chess, right? Well, the goal of chess is winning, right? Obviously, you could lose at chess, and then you've missed the mark. And then your acts, well, actually, all of your chess moves are going to lack a certain end and due order because you don't, in fact, attain the end that you're seeking. Okay, so just as Aquinas has, to our ears, a strangely capacious notion of evil, he also has a capacious notion of sin. So he's going to distinguish between missing the target with respect to skilled actions, and then he's going to talk about missing the target in the moral life. And the latter concept is the one that's familiar to us when we think about sin. But I want to say a little bit about the former concept because it helps to clarify some things about the latter concept, and it also sort of gives you a big picture of what he's thinking. So Aquinas would call failures or mistakes in skilled performances sins because they're simply missing the mark. So if a chef makes a risotto that's gloppy or he overcooks a steak, if an NBA player misses his shot, these are sins. For Aquinas, they miss the mark, they fail to hit the target at which the actor aims. But they're not moral sins in that they don't imply moral fault or guilt. Okay, now, in order to miss a target, you have to presuppose a capacity to hit the target, and that would be the skill. So think about Steph Curry. Steph Curry has a capacity to make three-point shots. I don't have this capacity. Although I have made a three-pointer like once or twice in my life, it has happened, but it was basically complete luck. So when I make a three-point shot, it's an accident. It's kind of a fluke. If Steph Curry makes one, it's the exercise of a skill. So the nature of the acts are different, even though in the random case where I make it, the outcome is the same. So what does it mean to make a three-point shot in a skilled way, kind of metaphysically? It means that the movements of his body are informed by practical principles. So he has sort of appropriate means or techniques or rules that govern his hitting the target. Steph Curry has a practical knowledge of these rules that he is deploying in his action, and it's this practical knowledge that explains his making the three-pointer, whereas I'm just throwing up a ball and hoping for the best. Now, the possession of a skill essentially involves knowledge of these practical principles or technique, but it's also more than that. Because as a longtime observer of the game, I might have some kind of observational knowledge of these principles. Like I might be able to describe how you're supposed to stand and where you go and what you do, but that doesn't mean that I can actually make a three-point shot. So skill is a habit. It requires habituation and practice, and that involves a change in bodily disposition. So there's like a lot of muscle memory involved and things like this. Another example, so my daughter Gianna, she's a very gifted pianist. So her fingerwork is very naturally agile and swift, but she also has to practice a ton. And she does this at the foot of some really exceptional piano teachers, so she has a kind of apprenticeship relationship. So over time, right, she is being habituated to execute in her activity practical principles and rules, in particular, like really complicated pieces of music that she translates into an audible reality. So both Steph and Gianna are guided by rules that they have internalized and that explain and perfect their acts. So these are the kinds of habits of the practical intellect that allow them to make a skilled performance a reality. And they don't really have to deliberate. They just kind of know what to do, and they do it. Now, if either one of them makes a mistake in performance, again, Aquinas is going to call this a sin. And he's going to call it a sin because it's a departure from the rule or measure in either case, and it's a departure from the rule or measure that prevents them from attaining the end. So it's a sin because it's a faulty action. So you can't think of sin simply as missing the mark, because sometimes you can miss a mark in a way that doesn't actually fault your action. So you could have a skill and it could be exercise, but it's impeded or interfered with in some sort of external way. And then we don't really fault your action. We look to explain missing the mark to whatever the interference was. So sin really has to be attributable to the agent, even if sin is just a matter of missing the mark in the sense of a skilled performance. Another thing to say, and this makes the sins of skill really different, is that with a skilled performance, you can intentionally miss the mark, and it's fine, and in fact, it might be productive. So a piano teacher might, and often does, intentionally play a piece very poorly. So this is sort of like knowingly mess it up. Now, you can only do that if you are a skilled pianist. I mean, I might sit down and just make a lot of noise, but it's not really doing anything other than making noise, whereas a skilled pianist can sit down at the piano and intentionally play wrongly in order to teach the skill. This would not be sin, right? Because the behavior itself wouldn't be at fault. Okay, now, the second sense of missing the mark that interests me underscores the fact that skills are what Aquinas calls a two-way power. So Aquinas thinks of natural powers as one-way powers, and that just means that unless they're interfered with, they're just going to do one thing, and they're going to do it naturally. So if you think about capacities for growth or reproduction, or even something like cellular mitosis, that's just a natural capacity in action. It's exercised in one direction. We can say what it is. And unless the power is interfered with in some way, it's going to do that. A two-way power isn't like that. A two-way power can go either way. So if you think about a skill like the art of medicine, so a doctor possesses the skill of the medical art. He can use that to either heal or harm. Interestingly, a doctor is equally good at harming a human body as he is at healing it. Now, the goal of medicine as a practice is ordered to healing the human body. But again, in terms of any individual doctor exercising his capacity, he could either heal or harm. Right, so it's a two-way power, and this ends up being very important because it means that we need to develop habits, what Aquinas would call habits, what we might nowadays call a disposition, but we need to cultivate these dispositions that are going to make it such that the power is exercised in one direction, namely the appropriate direction, and it's going to do that with ease. In the case of the medical art, that would be to heal. In the case of making a three-point shot, it would be to make the basket, ultimately to win a game. Okay, so why am I getting so much in the weeds of the metaphysics of skill? It's because of the following possibility. So imagine that Steph Curry intentionally misses shots during an NBA playoff game to ensure that his team loses. And he wants to ensure that his team loses for the sake of making money by illegally placing bets against his own team. This is to sin in a deeper and probably more familiar sense. He's going to cheat and lie for private gain. Now, Aquinas is also going to call this a failure to hit the mark. But it's not just a failure to hit the mark of making the basket, although it's also that, right? He's intentionally not making the basket. But now he's not doing it in a totally different way. And the mark that he's failing to hit is a different one. And this would be the mark of living a good human life or having human happiness. So Aquinas thinks, if we go back to this picture of substances as ordered to their natural goods, he thinks we have a natural good. It's human happiness. The point of any of our actions is to hit that target. And any of our actions are going to be assessed as good or bad in terms of whether they advance us towards that goal or whether it takes us away from that goal. So if we think of sin as just bad action, and then we think of sin as missing the mark, it's just any action that we do that actually impedes or prevents us from being happy. So that's the basic account of sin. So Aquinas thinks that Steph Curry's actions are ordered to an end whose intelligibility goes well beyond the end of winning basketball games. Even any of his basketball moves are ultimately ordered and measured by the end that constitutes human life as such. So whereas the skilled basketball player sins qua player when he fails to produce a good performance on the court by failing to apply the rules that govern his game, man sins qua man when he fails at human life by failing to apply the rules of right practical reasoning, which help him to attain his natural goal, which is human happiness. So that's the ultimate parallel given the differences that I've outlined. So when Aquinas talks about failing at life, he doesn't mean you failed at sort of like our familiar bourgeois standards, like you didn't get a house or a college degree and you don't have a fabulously beautiful Instagram feed. He just means that you failed to be happy. So to sin in the sense of moral fault, so when we talk about culpability, moral fault, is to knowingly do that which is contrary to the attainment of human happiness. So if we think about sin in that way, it's kind of like self-defeating, maybe self-destruction. It's knowingly choosing things that work against your own good. And I think when you realize that that's the fundamental structure of sin, it's really mysterious why we do that. And we do do it. We do work against our own natural good in a way that no other animal really does. I mean, other animals, you know, they get messed up, bad things happen, but it's usually explained by some kind of interference. Maybe something goes wrong with their habitats. They don't have access to the things that they need. But usually it's just like something bad happens. You know, they get, the antelope gets eaten by the lion, or, you know, Bambi gets hit by a car, but like Bambi doesn't go out on a bender or like gamble too much or do these kinds of really self-destructive things that human beings do. So humans are really weird in this sense that, like, unlike other creatures, we're almost hell-bent on messing up our own lives. So there's this question, why are we like this? So if we understand what sin is, there's this like really thorny question, why do we do that? It's very strange. So I want to I want to explore this question, why we sin. But first, I want to talk a little bit about what it looks like when we don't sin. So I want to say, because again, if evil is a privation or lack, we need to know what it's a lack of. So the question is, what does it take to be happy? And Aquinas' answer is that it takes virtue. So you have to cultivate. So just as in order to win the game, like, you have to cultivate skills, right, that are necessary for a skillful performance. In order to succeed at life or to be happy, you need to cultivate these other kinds of habits, namely the virtues. So there are the acquired virtues. Those are just going to be justice, practical wisdom, temperance, and courage. And then there's going to be the theological virtues. And those require God's grace and your cooperation with God's grace. And, of course, those are faith, hope, and love. Virtues are going to perfect your human capacities in such a way that when they are in exercise, they're going to attain your overall good. Let's just call that happiness. So you need to cultivate these virtues in order to live well. And happiness, it's important to say that for happiness for Aquinas is a common good. It's not a private good. And one thing that that means is that my happiness, the attainment of my happiness, if I'm at it in a truthful way, that involves the exercise of virtues, it's not competitive. So my happiness shouldn't detract from your happiness, right? It's not a competitive good, and we shouldn't be locked in a zero-sum game. And in fact, if in your pursuit of happiness you end up in competition with everyone else, that's basically the first sign that your vision of happiness is false, because it shouldn't be like that. Happiness is a common good, so the more of it I get, it doesn't in any way detract from you're having it. And common goods all have this feature. Like, the more knowledge I have, it doesn't detract from you getting knowledge. Like, it's totally fine. Okay. So why do we ever sin? Why do we do anything besides be virtuous? Aquinas' answer is that sin has three primary causes in the soul, and this is on your handout. There's ignorance, there's disordered passions, and there's selfishness of the heart. Now, the most serious sins are those done from malice. Sins of ignorance or weakness are factors that make the will's acts less voluntary, and we're less culpable for our sins to the extent to which they are less fully voluntary. So think about ignorance. If you don't know the target, if you don't know what happiness consists in, if you have a completely false vision of how to live, then you're not going to hit the target. So that's one explanation of not hitting it. You just don't know what it is. You don't know what you're doing. And Aquinas thinks some of that ignorance might be culpable, like you could have and should have known, but some of it's excused. The second source of sin is that you have disordered passions. So the example that Aquinas likes to use is Peter denying Christ, right? So Peter denies Christ. Why does he do that? It's because he's scared, right? He's afraid that he's going to be killed if he says that he's a disciple. And so in that moment of fear, he denies Christ. But as soon as the threat is removed, right, he feels immediate compunction. He realizes that he does something bad, and he goes outside and weeps. So that's kind of a case of clouded judgment, where something distracts you from what you know, or prevents you from executing what you know. And that's a real source of sin. Aquinas doesn't want to deny that Peter sinned, but he wants to say, well, you know, he had these disordered passions. It explains what happened. The worst kind of sin, and the kind that I think is most difficult to explain, is sinning from malice. So sinning from malice is when you just knowingly do what you know is wrong. So you know it's a sin, You know that it's wrong, so it's not ignorance. And you do it, like, kind of calm and deliberatively. So you're not all worked up about something. You're not, like, in a fit of anger. You're not scared to death. You're just like, yeah, I'm going to steal that because I want it. And you steal it. So that would be sinning from malice. And Aquinas writes of someone who sins from malice, not only will we say that the person wills the good that they chiefly will, namely the property that you want to steal, but also that they will the very deformity that they choose to suffer, lest they be deprived of the good that they desire. So basically, you just want something for yourself, and you're willing to knowingly suffer the disorder of sin in order to get it. Like, you just don't care. You're going to do it. And Aquinas says, this is a deformity of the will itself. So whereas ignorance is a defect or a lack in the intellect, there's something you don't know. Disordered passions is a defect of your lower appetites. You don't have total self-control over them. Will is a defect, like malice is a defect of the will. And this is a very strong sense of sin. And it's the one that Aquinas spends most of his time trying to explain. Why would you do that? Why would you put your personal private good over the good of others? And Aquinas basically says it's inordinate self-love. Like, you basically love yourself more than you love other people, and you're willing to put yourself over others. And he thinks about vice, which is the opposite of virtue, as settled malice. It's settled malice of the will. So vice is a settled disposition of the will, intellect, or feeling that inclines a person to acts of sin. These habits persist, and the person who acts from these vices begins to do them with a kind of ease and pleasure. So they enjoy their sins, basically. And Aquinas thinks that vice breeds more sin, right? So in the disputed questions on evil, he talks about the capital sins, right? The seven deadly sins. And the reason why they're deadly is that they are the fonts of all these other sins in your life. So if you think about greed, right? Greed is wanting things for yourself, a kind of covetousness of goods for yourself. And this will lead you to commit any kind of other sin, mostly injustices like fraud, lying, stealing, and cheating. Because what is most characteristic about the greedy man is that he just wants to accumulate more and more wealth for himself. And this leads to all kinds of other defects in him as a human person. Now, according to Aquinas, the vicious sinner, they're not crazy. What they do is intelligible because they want real goods. Like, wealth is a real human good, but they want it in a disordered way. And it's the disorder that makes the action a sin, right? And prevents them from actually being happy. And here, Aquinas is really following St. Augustine. So he says, all sin, even sins of ignorance and disordered passion, all sin ultimately arises because someone loves themselves too much to the neglect of the love of others. So sin really comes from being self-centered and being focused on the self. Now, one interesting case, I don't know if we have time to talk about it. Maybe we can talk about it in the Q&A if you want, is the fall of the devil, right? So the devil is an angel. So that means we're talking about a higher creature than ourselves. What's interesting to me about the devil and angels in general is that they're not subject to ignorance or error. So couldn't have been, the fall of the devil couldn't have been a result of something that he didn't know. He didn't have original sin. And he doesn't have passions. So he couldn't have been, like, afraid or something. Angels have attained their full natural perfection from the first moment of their creation. So imagine if you were born naturally perfected, which you definitely are not. But imagine if you were. And then imagine not choosing life with God. How is that possible? Aquinas' explanation goes like this. Angels, like all rational creatures, also have a supernatural perfection. That supernatural perfection is participation in God's eternal life. The devil sinned because he wanted to attain this transcendent good solely through his own natural abilities. So he didn't want to have to rely upon a superior to give him the gift of grace. He didn't want to have to depend on a superior. His pride made him refuse God's gift of grace out of, quote, pleasure in his own power. So again, somehow the angel, as a rational creature, has this ability to reject higher goods. And in this case, like a known higher good, because of some sense of his own importance or his own excellence. Now, why am I interested in the fall of the devil? Because I think it really gets to, well, I'm also interested in original sin, but the fall of the devil is like original sin on steroids. So I'll just turn to it. The reason why it's interesting is because people often try to solve the problem of evil, especially the moral problem of evil, by giving something called the free will defense. And the free will defense goes like this. Look, all evil comes from bad choices, right? And so it's not God's fault. It's us. We introduce all this evil into the world, and you can't put it on God, and the free will defense is supposed to get God off the hook. But I don't think this works, because I think it just pushes the question further back. For now, we have to ask, if freedom of choice entails the possibility of sin, of introducing evil into creation, why would God create creatures who can freely choose? Why wouldn't he just make us so that we just kind of automatically did what's good? He could have done that. That was definitely possible. So why wouldn't he do that? I mean, everything would be fine, right? We would be like, we'd be like all the other animals. We would just kind of naturally go for our good, and you know, maybe things might interfere here and then, but there wouldn't be this, there wouldn't be genocides and things like this. So why would he create free will if he knows that free will is going to introduce sin and evil? And I think really here we begin to enter into the mystery of love, about which philosophy can say a little, but maybe only so much. I think it can say this much. Love implies freedom. So love can be obliged, but it can't be coerced. It has to be freely given. Love is a kind of deeply and irrevocably personal act. To love someone is to choose to will their good. It's to desire real communion with them. It's also a will to suffer for them and to be radically vulnerable to them. I think all these things are entailed by love. Now, Aquinas thinks the happy life is the life of friendship. It's ultimately friendship and communion with God, right? That's the highest good that you can attain, and it's your perfect happiness. But all friendship is rooted in love that seeks common goods together. Sin as self-centeredness destroys bonds of love, especially through injustice. Now, God loves us, let's assume for the sake of argument, and wants us to love him in return. But just as God's love has to be freely given, so must ours. We must love our neighbors as ourselves, and to do that, we must love ourselves appropriately. That is to say, in a way that puts the good of others and friendship with them at the very center of our vision of how to live. So, like, we are all operating under some vision of the good life or how to live or happiness. If it's a true vision, then loving others and friendship with them, communion with them, is going to be at the heart of it. But now sin, like any sin basically, because all sin is a kind of self-centeredness, is going to prevent us from realizing that vision in our action. So when you look at it that way, sin is always a failure to love. But God has to allow that failure because it's basically built into the nature of love. It has to be freely given, which means that it can be freely abused. There's really no way around that. And to say that there's no way around it doesn't mean that God isn't really omnipotent after all because there's something he can't do. No, I mean, it's just part of the nature of love, and God's creation would be an expression of that. So I think we can say that much about love and creation and free will, and how this does involve reconciling ourselves to evil and sin and suffering. But I do think that a mystery persists. And that really is this mystery of, like, why it's so hard for us to be good. And this is, I think, a genuine mystery. So I do a lot of work with psychologists, and psychologists are basically the people that study all the ways in which we're completely messed up. And at the end of the day, if you ask a psychologist, why are we so messed up? They're just like, there's really no good explanation of that. It's really unconscionable. Like, I mean, we can just tell you, like, here it is, but ultimately we can't explain it. And here's, I think, where maybe we can turn to theology. And theology would complement philosophy, but it would go beyond it, and that it relies upon sacred scripture and interpretation of sacred scripture. But also, I think, you know, you kind of have to take a certain contemplative attitude about evil. I think that you have to reflect on it in a very deep and ongoing and engaging way, because it's not going to go away. It kind of keeps coming up, and you have to reconcile yourself to it. And I think that if you do that, like if you're willing to enter into a deep reflection on the reality of evil and sin, you come to think more clearly and more seriously about things like the atonement and Christ's suffering on the cross. And, you know, if you're a Christian, those are things that you're going to want to be contemplating anyway. And I think ultimately you're going to come to think in a deep and serious way about God's mercy and how you stand in need of God's mercy and love. And here you're going to go well beyond philosophy, and rightfully so. And I think probably even theology, and you're going to get into thinking about the way that the problem of evil is explored in literature and art and all of this. So just to have like one final thought, because I know I'm going a little bit over. If we return to the problem of evil under the guise of the moral problem of evil, as it's found in the Brothers Karamazov, I personally would want to agree with Dostoevsky that there's no neat and tidy rational philosophical solution to that. But I also think we should consider what turns out to be Dostoevsky's response to the moral problem of evil in that novel, and that comes out in the person of the elder monk Zossima. And what Zossima says is that we have to embrace the world. We do have to love the world, and in loving the world, including all of the suffering in the world, it will have a transfiguring effect on us.
So if we think about the lives of the saints, so like if you spend any amount of time reading the lives of the saints, these are almost always invariably people who have experienced great suffering in their lives and have in different and sometimes ingenious ways embraced it. And one thing you can say about them is that it definitely did transfigure them. It changed their hearts and their minds and the way that they lived. And I think that that kind of very practical response to the problem of evil, which is not so much philosophical, but is allowing the suffering of the world to really purify you and transform and transfigure you, holding out hope for the possibility of that kind of thing is definitely worth taking seriously. So thanks for your attention.
I have a question about back when you were talking about sins of skill.
Yeah.
So we have certain finite capacities as human beings, but they conflict with one another. So like I have the capacity to be probably not a good basketball player, but I could work on my skill as a basketball player.
Yeah.
Or I could use the same time that I could work on my skill as a chess player. But I have finite capacities for both of those. I also have a finite capacity for how good I could get at both of them at the same time.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? That they interfere with each other?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really problematic for something like basketball or chess, but we also have finite capacities for moral virtues. And or do we? Does Aquinas have any thoughts on that? Like, where they conflict is...
Well, so Aquinas, when Aquinas talks about the intersection of virtue and skill, which he actually talks about quite a bit, because he thinks that they're analogous, but also importantly different. He thinks that, like, skill is always held to a higher measure, right? So you could do things like quay chess player that are grossly immoral. For instance, you could cheat, which would involve you winning at chess, but is wrong. So there's always a measure of your actions, just qua human, that's going to be broader than the measure qua skilled performance. But as to whether, I mean, the question of our finitude, yes, sure, we are finite, but Aquinas does think that our... This gets a little metaphysical. But so our rational capacities, our capacity for intellect and will, are infinite to a certain extent, which it just means that, so he calls them spiritual powers because, in a way, through intellect and will, you can take on all things. And it has to do with the universality of concepts and the fact that these powers are never, so like, for instance, the will is never satisfied by any finite good, which is why your perfection, like joy of the will only comes once you have union with God. So it's actually a capacity, it's a spiritual capacity because, like, ultimately it's perfected by an infinite good. And so that's why I'm, like, hesitant about the finite language. But it's true that in terms of this life and making choices, it's like, yeah, we're finite and there are competing resources and you can only be so good at anything. But the point of your life isn't to be like the best chess player. I mean, like, it's great if you're the best chess player in the world. It's just the problem comes in if your obsession with that ends up making you a bad person.
I want to rephrase slightly.
Yeah.
So the chess and basketball are easy examples, but as a human being, I have capacity for reason.
Yeah.
As a human being.
Yeah.
I could attempt to perfect.
Yeah, that would be intellect.
Right, but then I also have capacities for love that I need to exercise to perfect. So, like, if I am forced to choose between reading more of the Summa or playing with my daughter.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Oh, I see.
To balance these two moral goods.
You should read them together. And everything's fine. Just read the Summa to your daughter. She'll love it. Yeah, I mean, so, like, practical wisdom is all about, like, trying to negotiate these things. And unless you have a contemplative life, so maybe you belong to a contemplative order or something, yeah, there's only so much. I mean, so I have 6 kids, so it's only so much time in the day for contemplation, but I definitely try to get it in. And I definitely try to prioritize it, because it is more important than, like, watching Netflix. So we do have to, so in making wise judgments, you know, we do have to make these very practical determinations. I think, you know, the moral life, the key to the moral life is making sure that any one of these goods doesn't take over to such an extent that it prevents you from, you know, so for instance, if your study of Aquinas were preventing you from loving your daughter and responding to her needs, then as much as I love Aquinas, like, I have to say, yeah, you shouldn't be doing that. But I think the focus has to be on friendship, because that really is the center and summit of the moral life. And of course, contemplation also makes you a better friend. For sure. But, yeah.
I have, like, 2 questions.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of like a comment.
Yep.
One question. So I don't know if you're familiar with Brian Davies.
Yes, he wrote a great book on this.
Yeah, I was watching a video, I guess.
He gets mad, though, if you call him Davies. Davis.
It's
Father Davis.
I have
yes, Davis.
Yeah, so I was listening to a video, I guess, that he was giving up, like,
mm-hmm.
a lecture on this type of, on this topic.
Yeah.
And I think one of his ideas was that one of the problems of, like, people in the when they create the problem of evils, they assume that God is, like, a moral agent,
mm-hmm.
so that you can kind of make him, like, the goal of, like, a theodicy is to, like, exonerate
right.
God from doing some sort of, or from, like, the evils that are in the world.
Yeah.
So, like, what do you think about that? As, like,
I think that, yeah, so I really like, so actually, Father Davis is really influenced by this Dominican, Herbert McCabe, and is actually Herbert McCabe's literary executor. And it's a development of this, I actually think, was Herbert McCabe's doctoral dissertation. It's called God and Evil in the Theology of St. Thomas Aquinas. And basically, McCabe's idea is that, you know, Hume and post-Humean approaches to the problem of evil really rest on suppressed premises that are deeply problematic and questionable. And one of them is that we're in a position to morally judge God's creation, which implies that there are criteria by which we could assess it, that God is another thing that stands within the system of our moral judgment. I mean, so basically the idea is we're trying to judge a transcendent, an utterly transcendent God, and that doesn't make sense. And is like a very un-Thomist thing to do. So I definitely have a lot of, I think there's a lot to that. That the problem of evil, as it's typically formulated, is not a problem that Aquinas would recognize. I think that's true. But that doesn't mean that Aquinas doesn't have resources for us to think about it. I do think that Aquinas would be against theodicy. I'm against theodicy. I find it sort of absurd to think that I could discern God's reasons. I don't see how I would be in a position to do that, given everything I believe about God and everything I know about myself. But I do think that Aquinas gives us resources for thinking about evil, and Aquinas does have a lot to say, especially in his commentary on the Book of Job, which I didn't talk about at all because it's really theology, and I just don't do theology. In his commentary on the Book on Job, Aquinas, which for him it's not a response to the problem of evil, but it's really about thinking about providence, right? So if we think that God has a loving and providential plan for us, what's up with Job? Because that looks kind of messed up. I mean, Aquinas really does confront the suffering of Job as like a real question for how to understand God's providence. But what he ends up saying, or at least one of the things he ends up saying in that commentary, is that, you know, suffering does very often bring about a greater good, especially for the person who undergoes it. So it has this kind of purifying effect on the human heart, and that God could permit it. Again, not directly will and intend it, because Aquinas does believe that God does not directly will or intend evil. He does think that that would violate his omnibenevolence. So God doesn't do that, but he does permit it because he thinks it does have these salutary effects. I think that does land Aquinas within the parameters of Ivan Karamazov's moral problem of evil, because, you know, it does create a situation where innocence can suffer, and you're going to have to think about why. So one of the things that Ivan says in The Brothers Karamazov is, I don't want this higher harmony. So, like, whatever greater good it brings about, it's not worth it. And that's the kind of thing that is going to touch Aquinas, whereas probably the first two aren't. Yeah. So I do think that we can't completely. So I have a lot of sympathy for Father Davis. But I think we can't completely unravel it. I think he's right. We should avoid theodicy. But we still have to think about how to respond to suffering and the fact that God permits it.
Let's give another round of applause.